Hello and welcome to this premium podcast on the evil origins of feminism. I am joined by Carl.
Hello.
The ultimate feminist nemesis, of course. I thought you were the best person to put through this.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's all right.
So, my sins.
Today what we're going to discuss is not the whole genealogy of feminism. It's not Mary Wollstonecraft, though she wants discussion at some point. There's obviously Shimola Firestone and nutcases like Kate Millett. What we're going to discuss is Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex.
Oh, good.
Because during my master's, I was put through this 900 pages of tripe, and it is the origin point from 1949 of all the contemporary feminist talking points. And I think most people haven't read it just because it's really long and really boring. But it's very instructive as to how the feminists actually think about the women that they're talking to.
So just to be clear, I haven't read it.
Yeah.
I've read a lot of feminist literature, but not that, actually. But I am familiar with her woman isn't... one's not born a woman, one becomes a woman. And she's not wrong on that.
But she's not wrong on that in the way that you would formulate it with your thick conceptual definition of womanhood.
Yeah.
That's not what she's going for.
Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll go through this. A little bit of background on Beauvoir. Born in 1908 to a very rich Parisian family. Her dad was a lawyer who once wanted to be an actor, and her mum was a wealthy daughter of a banker and a devout Catholic who, after the fortune nearly fell apart during the First World War, she sent her off to a very prestigious Catholic girls' boarding school. There she met a young girl that she fancied, and the girl died in 1929 of meningitis, so she was utterly heartbroken. She ended up writing Catholic schoolgirl erotica, which was never published until 2021.
Right. Okay.
So nearly 100 years later, it came out that she was into children from a very young age.
Oh.
Mm. She then hated her family, not just because of the religiosity, which she renounced at 14, but they tried to arrange a, quote, bourgeois marriage between her and her cousin Jacques, so she abandoned them.
Right.
So then in the fall of 1926, she began studying philosophy at the Sorbonne, where all good ideas go to die. In 1928-29, she wrote her graduate thesis on Leibniz, and then she took the aggregation exam in philosophy. At 21, Beauvoir was the youngest candidate to pass the exam, finishing second to Jean-Paul Sartre, who had taken the exam for a second time. And they actually got together. During her lifetime, though, Beauvoir and Sartre had numerous affairs with men and women, but maintained their main relationship. They're actually buried together now in a Parisian cemetery. And in 1930s, Beauvoir spent much of her time teaching philosophy until she was dismissed from her post in 1941 by the Nazis, who had occupied Paris in 1940. And we will see the ideas she thought would be a bulwark to Nazism as we go through her work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And she also found herself declaring herself a feminist in 1972, after in 1971 she had authored and signed Manifesto 343, which is a public declaration of 343 women who had admitted to having an abortion at a time when it was still illegal in France to push for legalization. And as Harry has already covered in his Left's Problem with Pedophilia video, she was a co-signatory of that famous letter along with Foucault and Sartre to abolish the age of consent in France.
Actually, it was to reduce it to 13. It wasn't to abolish it, but
oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Reducing it to 13 is pretty much the same.
So, as for The Second Sex, she first published this in, and I don't speak French, so excuse me, Le Demain Sexe, that was what it was originally titled, in Le Temps Moderne, which was a French journal founded by Beauvoir, Sartre, and Maurice Merleau-Ponty. From the book's introduction, and this is post hoc, the feminists now, who have called it the Feminist Bible, they've said, "The Second Sex has been called the Feminist Bible, an epithet bound to discourage impious readers wary of a sacred text and personality cult. Beauvoir herself was a devout atheist, as she had once been a Catholic, and she dismisses religions, even when they worship a goddess, as the inventions of men to perpetuate their dominion."
Hmm. Oh, that is embarrassing new atheist stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. But she doesn't actually dismiss all religions.
Right, okay.
It's a very interesting reading, and I think your recent burgeoning into Evola and my reading of Peterson's Maps of Meaning will inform her metaphorical and metaphysical worldview as we later go into her exploration of myth.
But okay.
And according to the translators, so obviously it was written in French originally, they say, "We did not modernize the language Beauvoir used and had access to in 1949. This decision precluded the use of the word gender, for example, as applied today."
Right, because so, it didn't exist then.
Yeah, because that was an invention post hoc by Judith Butler and Gender Trouble much later. Gender Trouble seemingly iterated on Beauvoir's formulation of one is not born but becomes a woman and literally reduced it to the performativity of costumes.
That's right.
Gender Trouble will be worth going through at some point because Judith Butler has the concept of homosociality, which is that men are only friends because they hate women.
I mean, that's true.
Moving on. So Beauvoir opens by doing something quite Nietzschean, actually. She proposes that all philosophies are projections of the philosopher. And I think that's pretty true, given that we just went through her biography.
Yeah, I think that's completely true.
She says, it is no doubt impossible to approach any human problem without partiality. Even the way of asking the questions of adopting perspectives presupposes hierarchies of interests. All characteristics compromise values. Every so-called objective description is set out against an ethical background. Instead of trying to conceal those principles that are more or less explicitly implied, we should begin better stating them from the start. Then it would be not necessary to specify on each page the meaning of the words superior, inferior, better, worse, progression, regression, and so on. So I would agree that that seems to be an aspect of many philosophies, specifically currently after the postmodernists have had their way with our culture, in that people are willing to justify in the public sphere the celebration of their personal vices. I think that's a break with the C.S. Lewis Tao aspect of where you're trying to identify some sort of common undergirded natural law.
Yes. But she isn't wrong that every way that any philosopher interfaces with the universe is through their own perspective and through their own experiences. That's why all philosophy is a form of self-confession. And she's not also wrong that, and this is what I covered in my conversation with Peter Boghossian, that actually Bernard Williams is right, that we can begin from within the human perspective, but her problem, the commitment to partiality becomes a kind of supremacist attitude in anything. Because you say, well, mine is mine, and therefore it's the best because it's mine. Mm. And all she's doing there is opening the door for anyone else to say, well, you're right. Actually, men are better and stronger. And we can do the Islamic thing of just merely enforcing our will on the women of the civilization if we want, because we're men and we have a class consciousness as men, and we're conscious of the fact that we are just physically stronger than you. And so now, what now, Simone? You know, and that, you know, you're going to be treated unfairly, and you don't want to be treated unfairly. And you've opened the door to this by trying to have it all one way and none of the other. I would actually suggest that it's more the sort of Burkean sentimental view that we should approach. Because, yeah, we are all first-person people, right? We'll live in our heads and we'll have to deal with the world. But we all have attachments and concerns for one another. And actually, if we nurture them more than this kind of doctrine of my rights, your wrongs, then actually we come to a position where compromise and care for one another is it informs our judgments about the world more than merely, how am I being oppressed? What do I deserve? What can I get from others?
Without spoiling the progression that I've got planned, she does eventually say that men and women can have relationships as long as it's founded on a principle of reciprocity, where no gender others the other, capital O, other. But then she simultaneously puts it in a Marxist framework.
She arrives back at the traditional position.
Yes. But then she also says we need gender socialism.
Okay, yeah, but she's wrong on that.
Yeah.
I mean, gender socialism is marriage. I'm not joking.
Literally the redistribution of one party to the other, yes.
Yes, I'm not joking.
Yeah.
Darling, I got a pay rise today. You mean we got a pay rise today? Okay, yes, darling, I did mean that.
There is an old Patrice O'Neill bit of where he goes, men think of I, women think of we. Like, a man will go, damn, we won the lottery. And his wife will go, damn, we won the lottery.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, I endorse that. It should be that way.
She then rejects natural law. So she says, we also repudiate any frame of reference that presupposes the existence of a natural hierarchy of values. For example, that of an evolutionary hierarchy. It is pointless to wonder if the female body is more infantile than the male, if it is closer to or further from that of the higher primates, and so forth.
Well, no, hang on. Right. She's right on that. Right. It is infantile to say that women are childlike or somehow regressed or something. Obviously, that's the case. To say I'm a person who is positioned within myself and I begin my philosophical examination from that position. Okay, but what is yourself if not a biological entity subject to all of the natural pressures that we describe as collectively natural law? What are you if not that? So
this is the madness of trans ideology, is that we have no apparatus but the body to interface with the world. So to speak of anything as inauthentic about your body is nonsensical.
And it, again, brings you into the kind of Gnostic realm that we've discussed already, and it, and Michael Knowles got one of them to admit to, in fact. So yeah, no, it's total nonsense.
So speaking of Daily Wire, what is a woman? We're going to answer this question. Beauvoir beat Matt Walsh to the punch. So her aim seems to be to monopolize a normative definition of femininity. So she says, everyone agrees there are females in the human species. Today, as in the past.
They did in the 70s, maybe. When was this written again?
1949.
Oh, 1949. Right, yes. Okay. They might have done in the 40s, yeah. But they certainly don't now.
No. Well, her making an assumed identity of womanhood and trying to politicize it did set the groundwork for now. Womanhood is just a costume.
Yeah.
They make up about half of humanity, and yet we are told that femininity is in jeopardy. We are urged, be women, stay women, become women. So not every female human being is necessarily a woman. She must take part in this mysterious and endangered reality known as femininity. Is femininity secreted by the ovaries? Is it enshrined in a platonic heaven? Is it a frilly petticoat enough to bring it down to earth? Although some women zealously strive to embody it, the model has never been patented. Yes. So, much like the critical race theorists with blackness, she then goes on to accuse the Enlightenment of making womanhood itself arbitrary.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
Yep.
Okay, Simone.
Does the word woman then have no content? Is it what advocates of Enlightenment philosophy, rationalism or nominalism vigorously assert? Women are, among human beings, merely those who are arbitrarily designated the word woman. American women in particular are inclined to think that woman as such no longer exists.
Okay, that's very interesting. So obviously it's not arbitrary. It's, as I talked about in my conservative definition of woman, directly connected to your biological reality. The fact that you are capable of conceiving and bearing children is the root foundation of being a woman. And then the social requirements that that has, that places on the female of the species, creates another layer to what womanhood is. And then that comes with that kind of normative, ethical layer. And on top of all of this, we have the aesthetics of being a woman. Mm. When a woman walks in wearing a beautiful dress and fills the room with perfume, you are very aware that you're in the presence of a woman.
Mm.
If a man does the same thing, you're very aware that it's a joke.
Yeah. Or that you're in the presence of a fetishist. What we're doing here, especially with your article, and I think I said this to you quite a while when you were putting it together, we're trying to reassemble the Russian doll that's just been disassembled in front of us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. She is right that the Enlightenment has done this.
Mm.
And Evola actually has a good take on this. There's a kind of spiritual aspect to all of this that is the thing I kind of left out of my article because I didn't want to go too far with it, you know. But what he calls the absolute man and woman, and this is what ultimately we are aiming for. And for women, it's to give herself entirely to someone else. For man, it is to give himself entirely to everyone else, to sacrifice yourself through labor or through war, and for a woman to sacrifice herself as a lover or a mother.
Mm.
And ultimately, is he wrong?
Yeah, Christopher Booker spoke about this in The Seven Basic Plots, about the anima principle, which makes women not the subordinate part of the story, but like the emotional sustenance which keeps the hero going.
Yeah.
It's the idea that Jordan Peterson says that a hero is a monster with a capacity for restraint. The woman gives him the impetus to be restrained, to move his strength from conquering and destroying to life cultivating and protecting.
She's like the North Pole on the compass.
Yeah.
That you're
guiding star.
Yeah, exactly. That you're, you know, directing yourself around. Mm. The man is directing himself around.
Now, the interesting thing about Beauvoir is she actually acknowledges the biological basis. She just doesn't like it.
Well, good for her for being able to acknowledge it. You know.
Inconsistently, but we'll go with
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah,
so, all that can be armed with certainty is that these two means of reproduction coexist in nature, that they both perpetuate the species, and that the heterogeneity of both gametes and gonad-producing organisms seems to be accidental. The differentiation of individuals into males and females thus occurs as an irreducible and contingent fact. So, because it's a contingent fact, we therefore have inevitable contentions arising out of the fact that neither of us can change our nature. And she dichotomizes a class struggle created by nature.
If it's a contingent fact, then it's dependent on something else. Mm. And that means that it could be changed if it could be caused to depend on a different thing. And this is where I think you end up at the Judith Butler position, where the entire thing is a social construct and based in social performativity. And so we arrive at transgender philosophy.
Yes.
And so I think actually there is a necessary aspect to this. It's intrinsic because of the nature of what a mammal is, frankly.
Well, so she does go on to say that the contingency clause is that culture conspires to make women's biology, their physically weaker and subordinate position, right, a cemented fact of how society should operate.
Right. Okay. So that's interesting, because I would say it's actually the other way around. I would say it's the biological reality of what women are compared to men that actually makes it a necessary connection to the society. The society comes after the biology. It doesn't come before the biology.
This is what you see with the Swedish studies that Peterson has touted throughout
history. Yeah, the Norwegian ones, where it's just like, look, the more free women get, the more womanly they become.
Yeah, because absent cultural factors, the biological factors get exacerbated and we become more different.
Yeah, that's exactly. Absent some direct, like, engineering project on the woman herself, she just becomes more like a woman.
But have you considered that women are subject to an engineering project that makes them like American slaves?
I have. Well, they are subject to an engineering product now.
Because of Beauvoir.
Yeah, exactly.
She's become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
She says, there are other cases where, for shorter or longer time, one category has managed to dominate another absolutely. It's often numerical inequality that confers this privilege. The majority imposes its law on or persecutes the minority. But women are not a minority like American blacks or like Jews. There are as many women as men on the earth. However, not one event, but a whole historical development explains their existence as a class and accounts for the distribution of these individuals in this class. There have not always been proletarians. There have always been women. They are women by their physiological structure. As far back as history can be traced, they have always been subordinate to men. Their dependence is not the consequence of an event or a becoming. It did not happen. Alterity here appears to be an absolute, partly because it falls outside the accidental nature of historical fact.
See, I would take objection to the term subordinate. It's just
complimentary.
But also venerated. I mean, I'm thinking of the ancient Venus statues. You know, we don't have many of them about men. You know, and when we dig up ancient caveman statues, they're always fat women with massive breasts who are pregnant.
There's the herbivorous men trend in Japan.
Yeah.
And that's only born out of men feeling subordinate to women having a massive influx into the workforce in such a short space of time, even shorter than we have in the West, and coinciding with the financial crash in Japan, the stock market in the 1990s. So that meant women have risen to the top of this pretty rigid familial structure like it was in feudal Japan. And now many men are checking out the dating market because they have no women that they feel they can be better than. And women don't want to date a man who's worse than them.
Well, women always becomes, date up,
Well, otherwise you become his mother and you don't respect him. You're not attracted to him. So they're just going, I might as well check out and literally marry anime waifu statues and things like this.
The anime waifu isn't going to out-earn you, is she?
No. So basically women need to hold men accountable. So I don't buy into her conception of patriarchy. And she fails to define it. She just takes it as a presupposition that
it exists. But also it comes from a position of profound safety. Right? She doesn't expect that a barbarian horde is going to break down the gates of her city and then carry her off as a slave.
Well, it has in Paris now.
Well, yeah. I mean, but in the 40s.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't think this is going to happen to her. And so she has the luxury of complaining that men are her protectors.
Well, that's quite funny, though, because that did happen in the 40s, because the Nazis literally occupied Paris and threw her out of the university. So where are the strong men then?
They didn't take her to the German tribes camp and rape her. Right?
Did lots of other Parisian women.
Sure, but not her.
Yeah, true. Well,
she's upper class.
Yep. So she at once calls this the construction and the enforcement of feminism by patriarchy as like a false consciousness, and then appoints herself the progenitor of the involuntarily politicized definition of what an authentic woman is. So she says, to prove women's inferiority, anti-feminists began to draw not only, as before, on religion, philosophy, and theology, but also on science, biology, experimental psychology, and so forth. At most, they were willing to grant separate but equal status to the other sex. That winning formula is most significant. It is exactly that formula the Jim Crow laws put into place, practice, with regard to black Americans. This so-called egalitarian segregation served only to introduce the most extreme forms of discrimination. This convergence is in no way pure chance, whether it is race, caste, class, or sex, reduced to an inferior condition. The justification process is the same. The eternal feminine corresponds to the black soul or the Jewish character.
That's fascinating. Right. So, I mean, to be clear, there is obviously much more difference between a man and a woman than there is a white man and a black man.
Yes.
And also, there is a necessary form of social segregation that must happen between men and women, because men desire something from women that women can't and don't want to, rightfully so, simply give up.
Yeah.
Right. It's sex. Right. White men and black men aren't desiring sex off of each other generally. And so actually they don't need to be segregated. Mm. There's no particular reason. You know, one isn't constantly trying to touch the other. And
unless you're in a gay bar.
Yeah, but this is a very... and you go in there by consent.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So it's a choice that you make. But this is the problem with trans bathrooms now, is there are lots of women who are well aware that in their daily lives, there are lots of men who give them attention. And it's attention that is, so we say, pre-sexual. Mm. It's a show an interest. And you, as a man, might not understand, because women don't do that to men, unless you're an unbelievably good-looking man. If regular men don't get the same sort of attention from women that women get from every man. And that's something that we should be sensitive to. We should understand. And it means they do deserve their own private spaces away from men. Mm. It's just one of those necessary things. It's not like being Jewish or black. There's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah.
And also, you know, there's a relative equality between men when it comes to size and strength. You know, you're at least adult men. And so you're expected to be able to defend yourself appropriately, but that's just not present between men and women. And so it's irrational to consider them to be the same. It's not correct.
Yeah. So despite acknowledging biological realities, she just dismisses everything you were just going to say and then doubles down on the Marxist framing by literally using the subject-object dichotomy and imposing it onto men and women.
But it's a false analogy at best. But what was the second part of that? She said something else that I thought was interesting. Can you read that out quickly again?
Yeah. To prove women's inferiority, anti-feminists began not only to draw on, as before, religion, philosophy, and theology, but also on science, biology, experimental psychology, and so forth. At most, they were willing to grant separate but equal status to the other sex. That winning formula is most significant. It is exactly the formula the Jim Crow laws put into practice with regard to black Americans. This so-called egalitarian segregation served not only to introduce the most extreme forms of discrimination, this convergence is in no way pure chance, whether it is race, caste, class, or sex reduced to an inferior condition. The justification process is the same. The eternal feminine responds to the black soul or Jewish character.
Right. So, again, very interesting how she accepts that actually we can't be objective or universal. We have to begin in our personal, particular, and parochial perspective. And yet she is now fallen back into, well, we're just the universal woman, the universal black, the universal Jew.
Yes.
Now we're outside of what it is to be that individual human being. Mm. Because if you ask the individual woman, she probably doesn't want naked men walking around in the women's changing rooms.
Yeah, not the wee spa.
Yeah, exactly.
It is strange that in all times and all places, she says patriarchy has arisen based on biological foundations and arbitrary, capricious cultural foundations.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we're going to year zero, cut it off, and suddenly be all universal humanity. And abide by all of the universal enlightenment doctrine, which was the cause of the hollowing out of womanhood in the first place, by springing forth into Marxism.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, that's precisely correct. So she can't have it both ways.
No. So then she says, hence woman makes no claim for herself as subject because she lacks the concrete means, because she senses the necessary link connecting her to man without positing its reciprocity, and because she often derives satisfaction from her role as the other.
Right, okay. Mm. When do women not make a claim? When do they not make a claim?
Yes.
That's almost all of modern politics.
But
women's rights.
It's because of their relative physical inferiority to men in terms of strength. They have the authority to make that claim on us, and it is noble for us to fulfill that claim.
Yeah.
So when she says there, she often derives satisfaction from her role as the other, she is coping and seething over the fact that women, they don't acknowledge they have a false consciousness. They actually kind of like it. They like being looked after.
And also, they've got a kind of social superiority over men, which they will always have. And this, women, you know, women don't make a claim to themselves. No, they do. And they do it all the time. And they do it as women to men in the knowledge that men are ethically obligated. And it's kind of a natural moral obligation in almost all civilizations to bow almost, to bend the knee to what it is a woman is demanding. It's noble. It's considered right, and it's wrong not to do it. And this is one of the reasons that Western societies just despise Islamic societies.
Mm. Yeah, because they are incapable of restraining their own sexual urges, so they just have to repress women and put them in bin bags rather than taking personal
make
responsibility.
Make them live, as Evola said, like ascetics.
Mm.
And it's just like, yeah.
I'd rather not, thanks.
Yeah.
But because she can't shake women out of their biological desires, she needs to...
Are you sure you don't want to give up your position of privilege, ladies? That's what she's asking.
Sorry, I can't hear you from the kitchen. She needs to tell them, to propagandize them into acting against their own biological self-interest. So she says, the proletariat could not plan to massacre the whole ruling class. A fanatic Jew or black could dream of seizing the secret of the atomic bomb, or could plan rather, could seize of seizing the secret of the atomic bomb and turning all of humanity entirely Jewish or entirely black. But a woman could not even dream of exterminating males. The tie that binds her to her oppressors is unlike no other. The division of the sexes is a biological given, not a moment in human history. Biological need, sexual desire for posterity, which makes the male dependent on the female, has not liberated women socially. Master and slave are also linked by a reciprocal economic need that does not free the slave. That is, in the master-slave relation, the master does not posit the need he has for the other. He holds the power to satisfy this need and does not mediate it. The slave, on the other hand, out of dependence, hope, or fear, internalizes his need for the master, however equally compelling the need may be to them both. It always plays in favor of the oppressor over the oppressed. This explains the slow pace of working class liberation, for example. Now, woman has always been, if not man's slave, at least his vassal. The two sexes have never divided the world up equally, and still today, even through her, though her condition is changing, woman is heavily handicapped.
That is an amazing paragraph. So women aren't like blacks or Jews, yep. Actually. And that's how they're not like blacks and Jews.
Because they can't just kill all men and solve the problem.
Yeah, but also the vassal is amazing, because I'm just thinking who I give my money to.
Yep.
And my wife doesn't give me her money. I'm the one who gives her money. Like, if there's a vassal relationship there, I'm the one paying tribute.
I had this conversation with Louise Perry. In her book, I took up issue with her dichotomizing the sexual revolution as an inversely Marxist project of where it was waged by feminists, some of whom were socialists, but it has created a sexual marketplace where attractive women of the oppressed proletariat and hyper-sociosexual men who can have sex with many of them are the bourgeoisie who hold a small amount of sexual capital in their hands. And I just said, based on Thomas's idea of the OnlyFans cartel, Chris Williamson said he called it the cartel of female sexual self-exploitation. Mm. I said, is it not the truth that you have an underclass of hopeless coomers neurologically addicted to the most attractive women they'll ever see, and they're consolidating the sexual capital in their hands? And she went, well, yeah, I guess so.
It's obviously the case.
Yeah, it's reciprocal exploitation.
Yeah.
And this is the conditions that Beauvoir has created. So that's why we cannot have relationships in this day and age very easily, specifically among the Zoomers.
Again, and just to characterize the relationship between a husband and a wife as a master-slave relationship is just awful.
Yeah,
no one thinks of that. And if you just walk outside, just watch, you know, husbands and wives in the street just getting their shopping and stuff. Mm. This is not a master-slave relationship. Don't be ridiculous. Mm. I mean, maybe it was in the 40s in Paris. I doubt it, but I mean...
Well, we're also... She's also talking from the position of never having been married and having a polygamous relationship with a man whose physiognomy is despicable.
Well, I suppose from an aristocratic perspective, maybe if she's being forced into, she's a lesbian being forced into a relationship with a man, maybe from her perspective it does seem that way.
Yeah.
But that's a very unusual set of circumstances.
Mm, yeah, well, back when she said all philosophy is repression and then projection, seems like it, doesn't it? So then she blames men entirely for women's inequitable social and economic conditions. She says,
I hate my dad.
In no country is her legal status identical to man's, and often it puts her at considerable disadvantage. Even when her rights are recognized abstractly, long-standing habit keeps them from being concretely manifested in customs. Economically, men and women form almost two castes. All things being equal, the former have better jobs, higher wages, and greater chances to succeed than their female competitors. They occupy many more places in industry, in politics, and so forth, and they hold the most important positions.
What an absolutely tiresome feminist talking point that's so obviously not true. Get in the sewers, clean them out.
But it's not. It's not Tyler's feminist talking point. It's only Tyler's to us because we heard it in 2015 to now. This is the origin point.
Well, yeah, but it's...
They haven't moved on in nearly 100 years.
And it's probably not true then. Men have got all the nice jobs, yeah, but they also have all the terrible jobs.
Yeah, and that's why it says, all things being equal, we aren't. When I've had fights all the time, I say, when a girl whines at me, I'll just go, you don't get equal, you get fair.
Yeah.
That's the truth. Yeah, we respond to things in different ways. We handle things in different ways. And you have to take that complementary aspect into account. Otherwise, you'll never solve a problem. But she doesn't want to solve a problem.
Women's mad.
Yeah. Women's unique and contingent relationship on men means that dialectical historical materialism is insufficient to solve the class oppression. Now, this is an interesting admission, because then she said, it's mainly all cultural, and I acknowledge the biological, but because we can't kill all men, Marxism isn't enough. We need feminist Marxism.
Hmm.
He says, the sexual relation that unites woman with man is not the same as the one he maintains with her. The bond that attaches her to the child is irreducible to any other. She was not created by the bronze tool alone. The machine is not sufficient to abolish her. To demand, well, wait till we get to artificial wombs. To demand woman all the rights and all the possibilities of the human being in general does not mean that one be blind to her singular situation. To know this situation, it is necessary to go beyond historical materialism, which only sees men and women as economic entities.
I mean, great. I agree that we shouldn't just view men and women as economic entities. But why are you sat here complaining about the jobs women do? Why are you talking about this workplace inequality?
Why are you itemizing down to material distribution of power, wealth, and land along race, gender, and class lines, as Ash Sarkar would once say?
And there was can you read that quickly again?
Yep.
So there's another bit in there that I wanted to pick out.
The sexual revelation, sexual relation that unites woman with man is not the same as the one he maintains with her. The bond that attaches her to the child is irreducible to any other. She was not created by the bronze tool alone, and the machine is not sufficient to abolish her. To demand woman. For woman, all the rights, all the possibilities of the human being in general.
Right. It's that, right. So all the possibilities of a human being in general.
Mm.
That seems like a bit of a high standard.
That's an insane abstraction, because women and men aren't human beings in general, because there is no human being in general. You cannot have a human being abstracted from the sex binary.
And there is no man who has opened to him all the possibilities of a human being in general.
Mm.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm 5'9", never going to be a basketball player. That's never going to happen. You know, I'm never going to be a powerlifter. You know, I'm never going to be an astronaut. There are so many things that are just closed to me because of what I am.
Yeah, with my ears, I'm never going to be a hat model.
Yeah. But that's the point, isn't it? So she's taken the abstract universal woman after saying this doesn't exist. And now that's the standard by which all women must be at least theoretically able to attain. And so it's just not true.
Mm.
It's just not going to happen. It's absurd.
Speaking of things which are really ill-defined, patriarchy.
Oh, yeah.
She never actually defines it.
Why would she?
She just presupposes its existence to the point of where it seems so all-pervasive and predates communication, the discovery of continents and the like, that it must just be a biological phenomena. So either women abolish their biology entirely, as we see with the present, or... Yep. Beauvoir's plan will never come to fruition. So she says, the two sexes are necessary for each other, but this necessity has never fostered reciprocity. Women have never constituted a caste.
What?
Establishing exchanges and contracts on an equal footing with men. History has shown that men have always held all the concrete powers. From patriarchy's earliest times, they have deemed it useful to keep woman in a state of dependence. Their codes were set up against her. She was thus concretely established as the other. The condition served males' economic interests, but it also suited their ontological and moral ambitions.
Amazing. It's been a universal conspiracy by men since the dawn of humanity to keep women down.
There is a tweet recently that went out, and it said, and I think it was to do with the dog girl that has since been banned, and it said, women post things like this, and they wonder why in all times, all places, all civilizations, men have done things to keep them in check.
I just find this fascinating. Mm. Like, the idea that the Stone Age man is like, you know, I need to worry about women's economic success.
I could take down this mammoth, or I could oppress the wife.
Yeah, well, I'm worried that she's going to take down the mammoth instead. Yeah. You know, like, she's got a baby on her hip, but she might come out here and chuck that spear half as far as I can, half as hard as I can, and take down the mammoth. And then she's going to drag it back to the cave.
Yep.
It's like, look, come on. Man, this is a childlike view.
Yep. Also, mythology and narrative and religion itself is an architecture of patriarchy, even though they all disagree. So,
and on the points that they do agree, they're obviously talking about some sort of biological substructure of what it is to be a human.
Yep. Jainism, obviously an architect of patriarchal conspiracy. This is why religions and their codes treat women with such hostility. By the time humankind reaches the stage of writing its mythology and laws, patriarchy is definitively established. It is males who write the codes. It is natural for them to give woman a subordinate situation. One might imagine, however, they would consider her with a benevolence as children and animals. But no, afraid of woman, legislators organize her oppression.
That's interesting, actually, because in a way she's right. The religious and law codes were written by men. That's fine. I can totally grant her that. But why? Why are these men afraid of women? Why do you need to be afraid of something that's powerless? You wouldn't. You're not afraid of the mouse that's entered into your house. You're not afraid of, you know, anything that can't do any damage.
Mm.
But in all times and all places, it's been well understood that women are very powerful. Actually, women's reproductive capacity is very powerful. And actually, it's got the potential to totally ruin society if mishandled. Let's say via OnlyFans or something like this.
Yep.
Or via Tinder, via massive amounts of what we would call sexual immorality. And so strict rules on both men and women for when it comes to relationships and reproduction were imposed because it was understood this would keep the civilization healthy and not have it tear itself apart into constant revenge for infidelity. That was what was understood.
Between men as well. Powerful.
Yeah, exactly. That was the key point. Each man wanted one woman, and the woman should want one man. And if that was not respected, and it's the woman's choice on who gets to have sex with her, well, she could do a lot of social damage with that power.
There's also nothing in here about the controlling of disease, which is one of the reasons for monogamy, so you don't discontinue the tribe.
Obviously, but like, but I'm thinking really in like willful social damage.
Yeah.
And women hate women who do this.
Oh, yeah.
Like women are the...
I remember when you went through the Twitter thread of how to steal another man's boyfriend, and Harry said, oh, it happened to me. It's also attempted to be happened to me.
And
women despise other women that do this subterfuge.
Because they know that is fundamentally the power of women over men.
Yeah, and the power of women over men as well is that rejection represents reproductive discontinuity. Like you have the Medusa stare of a woman's approval. And many men, this is what stops them in today's day and age from taking the risk of ever asking a woman out in the first place.
Yep. And also, you can see that this is a power and privilege that women exercise so much when you reject a woman.
Mm.
No one takes rejection as badly as a woman.
Yes.
Sexual rejection is, I've only experienced it a couple of times, but it's just like, oh wow, she's really angry. You know,
I'll say no more. I prefer not to speak. If I speak, I'm in big trouble.
But it's actually remarkable. And when you compare it to every man you know and yourself, you know, you offer a woman out on a date and she's like, no, you know, and you have to take it on the chin.
Well, I think that's because though most women will not date a man unless they have had the conceived fantasy in their head of how it will play out. So they need to have a ahead of time investment in you as an idea before they'll agree to a date with you. Whereas most men will see women on a surface level and go, she looks pretty and nice, I'll find out more about her.
Yeah.
And they're the ones actually investing the capital in it so they can do a turnover. But women are investing the higher level of parental investment, which is risked if she sleeps with this guy.
I do also think that the fundament of a woman being outraged that she's been rejected by a man is kind of arrogance as well. It's kind of the, of course I can have sex with a man.
Yes.
Of course I can. And how dare you say you don't want to have sex with me?
Mm.
You know, so it's a big Freudian thing to go into, I suppose.
Oh, she speaks loads about, we'll get onto.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Because that is actually the foundation of pretty much all of her arguments.
Oh, I bet it
is. But then there is a great mask off moment that we'll go through later. So she says, the triumph of patriarchy was neither an accident nor the result of violent revolution. From the origins of humanity, their biological privilege enabled men to arm themselves alone as sovereign subjects. They never abdicated this privilege. They alienated part of their existence in nature and woman, capitalized both, but they won it back afterward, condemned to play the role of the other. Woman was thus condemned to possess no more than precarious power, slave or idol. She was never the one who chose her lot. Men make gods and women worship them, said Fraser. It is men who decide if their supreme divinities will be females or males. The place of a woman in society is always the one they assign her. At no time has she imposed her own law.
Amazing. Because, I mean, she ascribes way more agency to men than they deserve. Men didn't really get to decide that the gods would look like they look. It kind of evolves, right? It's... As far as the men are concerned, it's a discovery, not an invention. It's not capricious or arbitrary. But also, you're the sovereign citizen. Mm. Now you're being conscripted into the French army to get gunned down by the Nazis.
Yes.
Like, look at your privilege as you march away to get killed by Nazis.
Yeah, and leave your wife behind to potentially get raped by a German soldier.
Yeah, exactly. It's an unbelievable caricature of what people actually went through.
Yeah. So biology itself is oppression. So goes on to later establish how all of history is, what was actually the quote? The real reins of the world have never been in women's hands. They had no role either in technology or economy. They neither made nor unmade states. They did not discover worlds. Only since women have begun to feel at home on this earth has a Rosa Luxemburg, communist, or Madame Curie emerged. They brilliantly demonstrate that it is not women's inferiority that has determined their historical insignificance. It is their historical insignificance that has doomed them to inferiority.
Right. That's amazing. So when the world was dangerous and difficult, Women didn't want to be in charge. They didn't want to be exploring. They weren't demanding equal rights. But once Western man had pacified the world and made it safe and predictable and had established sufficient law and order in so that women can operate with...
relative safety?
Yeah, relative safety and freedom that their ancient grandmothers wouldn't have dreamed of because of the danger of it, then they're like, oh, finally, we're not being oppressed.
Mm.
It's like, no. Like, you are inheriting something that took so much blood, sweat, and tears to construct. It would be at least nice to have some respect for that.
Yeah, this is the abolition of gratitude and therefore the feeling of entitlement entering by the back door.
It's remarkable.
Yeah. So she says about biology, women's history is much more complex. So she begins with the androgyny at childhood. She presupposes that we are born basically blank slates. In as much as he exists for himself, the child would not grasp himself as sexually differentiated. And then this is some quotes I've had to splice over the course of quite a few pages. But at puberty, the species reasserts its rights, obviously with the cycle of menstruation. Some women manifest virile characteristics. Too many secretions from the adrenal glands give them masculine characteristics. These anomalies are absolutely not a victory of the individual over the tyranny of the species. Gestation is tiring work that offers women no benefit as an individual, but demands serious sacrifices. So,
okay,
having a family and children is... no reward.
That's amazing, yeah.
Yep. So then she says sexual reproduction itself is oppression.
Right.
Male domination
is
expressed by the coital position of almost all animals. The male is on the female, and the organ he uses is incontestably material too, as if the vagina is an immaterial void of all times and spaces.
She would say it's a dominating position.
Yeah.
But have you asked women if they like it or not?
But it is seen in an animated state. It is a tool where the female organ in this operation is merely an inert receptacle.
Oh, come on.
Have you ever been called an inert receptacle, darling? Is it really a good pet name to call your wife?
Who's she been having sex with if they're just inert receptacles?
Other women?
Well, yeah.
The male deposits his sperm, the female receives it. Thus... thanks very much.
That's very romantic, yeah.
Thus, although she plays a fundamentally active role in procreation, she endures coitus, which alienates her from herself by penetration and internal fertilization. Although she feels a sexual need as an individual need, since in heat she might seek out the male, she nevertheless experiences the sexual adventure in its immediacy as an interior story and not in relation to the world and others.
Right.
Why would you want your sexual adventure to be in relation to the world and others?
Has she asked any women if that's a problem?
That would be wonderful. It doesn't really come up in this. Most of her citations are actually case studies from Freudian psychoanalytic journals.
Right, because there are loads of women who think that's brilliant.
I've met some.
Yeah, I've had sex with a few, and they all seem to quite enjoy it.
So she says, the woman is impregnated through the vagina and it becomes an erotic center uniquely for the intervention of the male, and this always constitutes a kind of rape.
Oh.
So all heterosexual sex is rape.
I'm not making any comments on this.
It is uncommon that the young girl's first experience is a real rape and that the man's behavior is odiously brutal, particularly in the countryside where customs are harsh. It often happens that a young peasant woman, half consenting, half outraged, in shame and fright, loses her virginity at the bottom of some ditch. What is, in any case, an extremely frequent in all societies and classes is that the virgin is rushed by an egotistical lover seeking his own pleasure quickly, or by a husband convinced of his conjugal rights who takes his wife's resistance as an insult to the point of becoming furious if the deflowering is difficult. In any case, however deferential and courteous a man might be, the first penetration is always rape.
Right, that's just not my experience of life.
That's just not true at all.
Yeah.
And also, and this might be a contentious thing to say, but if you are married, you sign a contract, and it's not meant to be contractual because you're committing yourself to something higher than yourself, because marriage is for the kids, not necessarily the husband and wife. But if you are claiming sexual exclusivity, then you do have an obligation to make sure that the other person is satisfied. That doesn't justify rape, of course not, but you should want to make your partner happy.
I've never met anyone in a relationship who doesn't want to have sex with their partner. At least at some point hasn't had
one. Well, Simone de Beauvoir wants to have sex with multiple partners, so please excuse this.
Relation réduit toute tierce personne à un rôle secondaire.
Oui, c'est-à-dire que les tiers, tant dans la vie de Sartre que dans ma vie à moi, évidemment, dès le début, savaient qu'il y avait une relation qui écrasait celle qu'on avait avec eux. C'était très souvent pas très agréable pour elles. C'est vraiment les tiers qui ont fait les frais un peu de cette relation que nous avons établie entre nous. C'est donc, elle n'est pas non plus incritiquable, cette relation, puisqu'elle implique que quelquefois, on ne se conduise pas très correctement avec des gens.
Quelquefois, ça a été sur le dos des autres.
Voilà, oui. Exactement.
C'est ça.
It's just nonsense.
So reproduction itself means that women have no autonomy. It is understood that the male has integrated the forces of the species into his individuality, whereas the woman is a slave of the species. Pregnancy is above all a drama playing itself out in the woman between herself and her and herself. She experiences it both as enrichment and a mutilation.
Got to be at work at 7 o'clock in the morning. Got to get up at 5 o'clock to get ready. You know, but you're free. You're the one who's just got the reins of the civilization in your hand, man. You know, honestly, such total.
The fetus is part of her body, and it is a parasite exploiting her. Where have you heard this before?
Oh my God, that is awful.
Yep.
That is awful.
That is awful, and it is now the dominant hegemonic narrative by the pro-abortion position. Yep. She possesses it, and she is possessed by it. It encapsulates the whole future, and in carrying it, she feels as vast as the world. This actually sounds like the UNN's definition of woman, doesn't
yeah.
it? But timeless, formless, and eldritch god.
But it's very interesting how, again, she's acting like she's not a person in a body. She doesn't have emotional states.
Yep.
She's talking as if she's some sort of disembodied rational will that's just abstractly analysing. So, it's like, okay, well, that's fine. You can take that position if you want. But why did you begin by saying we're all in a particular perspective? You know, don't begin by saying that if you're not going to then embody the woman's perspective. Because actually, when they get pregnant, a lot of women feel a lot more love than they did previously. Mm. And they get a lot more emotional.
It's oxytocin. She actually says, right, she also feels like the plaything of obscure forces. She is tossed about, assaulted. Now, she conceives it as a form of violence, but we are all subject to a form of obscure force that on neurochemistry, we have no real control over. Like when we're really tired at the end of a workday and also testosterone can flow, we can snap a bit, we can get a bit grumpy, right? Just as women can weep and get a bit overly sensitive. Yeah. When we're not all rational beings, we're not all hyper-perfect. So then for the postmodernists and Beauvoir specifically, I think this is why she is one of the shining examples of how they work, to then pretend that all philosophy is projection that comes before me, but now I am the individual rational arbiter of what is true. I can comprehensively provide a worldview, and it just so always happens to end up in my preferred form of socialism. I think it's a dishonest praxeological tool to make you nihilistic so then they can ideologically propagandize you.
Yeah. And the way in which it renders everything about the human experience as essentially evil is just dishonest. Like, because we're living in the world, we can see that that's not the case. And you are pretending like you're acting like some sort of godlike rational judge, and you're not, and you know you're not. This is obviously, as you say, a projection, and seems quite Freudian in many ways to me, especially her description of sex. It's like, look, that is one way of looking at it. Mm. Another way of looking at it is it's an act of union and love, and the two parties are both bathed in a warm and, you know, happy glow, and they form an intimate connection that is going to last their entire lives. You know, there's another way of rendering it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.